Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. I want everyone to call in or just listen in as our guest, Fran Dow, has been respectfully coming back on the show this month every Wednesday at 2 o'clock p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Fran Dow is a former seven-year warden from Amsterdam who has worn many hats in the areas of criminal justice, whom has and continues to work with the Dutch Ministry of Justice, the United Nations, the ICRC, the Global Initiative on Psychiatry, Mainline, and Council of Europe, returns to do two main subjects per season, all seasons listed below. Franz will be talking today about mediation between perpetrators and victims. He will be returning next Wednesday to talk about medical care in the prison. He will come on the following week to discuss relations between staff and inmates. The fourth week, he will be talking about involvement of closed ones or working with experienced experts. He will, following that week, meaningful activities or relatable security. And lastly, traumatized staff and inmates. So let's welcome once again Franz Dow from Amsterdam. Franz, we are so honored to have you coming back on. I thank you so much for taking the time to do these series.
I'm so honored too to that you give me the floor to tell something about my experience and knowledge. I really am grateful for that.
It's time for change. And we need somebody with some expertise to talk about some of these issues that really need to be addressed. So the floor is yours.
Yeah. Well, let's start with a very basic principle and a very basic questions. And the question is, do you believe that when violence has happened, when crime has happened, that you can restore the situation for people who are perpetrator and or are victim or survivors who have lost a loved one or something? Do you believe in that? That's a very basic question. And well, I believe that you cannot restore totally the fact that you lose somebody or that you have been hurt, that you have marks. I don't think you can repair it like you can repair a car and everything is okay. But I surely believe that after violence and after a crime, the people involved, both the victims and the perpetrator, can go through a process in which they learn how to deal with the consequences of what happened, and they can make room to lead a meaningful life. And they are not condemned the rest of their lives to, like the victims or the survivors, to be busy, make the perpetrator one of the most important, of even the most important person in their life, because they took away their loved one, for example, but then they can make room to live further with have all kinds of meaningful relationships in the family and in the society. I really believe in that. And there are a few levels in which I have experience with that. One of the most well-known experience is that when I was prison governor, and also after that in the Foundation of Recovery in Return, the foundation that I founded with a former incarcerated person, a friend of mine, we bring the victim and the perpetrator together, or the survivor and the perpetrator together to meet. And that's a very important process, and I would like to say a few things about that and about exactly the way we do that. One of the both parties says he or she wants to speak to the perpetrator or to the party of the victims or the family of the victims because he or she wants to know certain things. That's how did it happen exactly? Why did you do it? What happened during the crime, etc., etc. And the other one, the perpetrator often wants to do something to say sorry, to diminish the pain of the people he wants to talk to get to make certain steps to process for him or her the consequences of what he or she did. And my experience is that often the subject of forgiveness or saying sorry or regrets, there's often spoken about that during the trial. And I believe that's not the right moment usually to talk about that. Why not? One of the things is that when the trial is going on, there are a lot of interests of both parties to defend or to persecute the other one. It just happens, usually, the crime, and nobody is ready for some kind of mediation or reconciliation. And I'm talking about severe crimes, of course, about severe violence and not about material conflicts or something like that. So what you see is that in Holland, for example, since a few years, the victims have a right to talk in the courtroom. And what you see is that often it's not very nice for the consequences are often destructive because the perpetrator can't say sorry at that moment. And the reaction is not what the family, for example, expects to get from the perpetrator. One thing is that the perpetrator often and almost usually does the crime because he is hurt somehow in his life or in the period before the crime. And instead of processing and dealing with his own pain and his own sorrow or anger, he reacted out on the victim. And so, and the point is that when you don't confront yourself with your own pain and the things that happened in your life, people tend to give it through to other people, usually people who didn't do anything, had nothing to do with the pain that was caused by somebody. So usually the perpetrator needs to go to the process of seeing his own pain, being confronted with his own pain, empathize with himself, you know, see what happened and feel what happened. And after that process, he usually is ready to empathize with the victims and the family. So what I see a lot is that when it's when we're talking about a conversation, a meeting between the perpetrator and the family of the victim, for example, people are ready somewhere between 5, 10, 15 years. it takes before they really can have a meeting like that at both sides. Because they both go through a whole process of anger, of pain, and have to take really a few steps, or sometimes a lot of steps, before they are ready to be confronted with the perpetrator or with the victim. And what you also see is that when you go through this process, the perpetrator and the victim, they really need to be ready and really feel the need to get the other party out of their lives in a way. They will never get out of their lives, and the crime can't be, you can't say that the crime didn't happen. It will be with you the rest of your life, yes? Did you ask something?
Oh, no, no.
Okay.
But I would like to ask a quick question, though. You mentioned a lot of times these people are hurting, and they take it out on the wrong people.
Exactly.
The person that they take it out on, it's to get rid of their own frustrations, but they take it out on people that have had nothing to do with the pain that they experience. I wanted to ask you a quick question before you go on, Franz. What do you think about including these type of restorative justice and between prisoners and the victims? What do you think about the inclusion of that in the prison system?
I think that is a very, very good idea. I think it has to start in the prison system. I think that when you there's one thing you do in the prison, that's locking up people. But what you also want is that when they get out, they don't commit any crimes anymore.
Exactly.
So it's very important that in the prison you focus on people to invest in this, in themselves, in their own square meter. And that's not only with studying and activities, but it's also processing this pain, dealing with their own traumas, trying to understand themselves, trying to be to confront themselves with their own pain and their own sorrow. And I think the most important thing the prison system can do is to create an environment, a living climate, in which the perpetrators, the people, the incarcerated people, can show emotions at certain places and can get a room to go through this process. And it can sometimes be very emotional and sometimes shocking for staff members when people start crying the whole day or get very, very angry, very desperate and stuff like that. But the point is that when they don't go through that process and in themselves, it is almost impossible to not react from that same pain inside and outside prison. So I think the most important thing that you can do in the prison, and I can say that I've seen and done that a lot of times, is just be with the people inside, the incarcerated people, respect them, and let them know in all kinds of in different ways that they, that what they did is a very horrible crime, very violent, very bad, very bad act. But let them know that they can be the person that they are. They can be themselves. Never reject somebody because he is who he is, because I think that's a very basic principle that everybody needs to be heard, needs to be seen, and needs to hear that there are other people who respect who he is and give him the recognition for who he is. I think then you have a climate in which people are able to, you know, to think about themselves. And it's not that you have to confront them as a warden or as a guard or as a social worker with their pain. You don't have to do that. Just stay with them. Just stay with them. Be involved with them. And I'm a sort of person that believes almost in everybody because I see a lot of good in a lot of people. People who did horrible things, and I see very good things, and that's where my attention goes to. So often people have the feeling with me and with staff who are the same as me that they can be who they are and that they can make mistakes, that they can talk about some things that they feel and they probably never shared with somebody. And then you just follow them, stay with them, and follow them on the process of processing their pain and making their own square meter clean, cleaning their own square meter from pain, from all kinds of prejudices, ideas, etc., etc., that make them commit crimes.
I've heard from many prisoners throughout the years, I've heard from prisoners saying that they can't express or show their emotions behind the prison mm-hmm. walls because of yeah. others. And have you ever encountered any of that in your 27 years as a warden?
All the time. The prisons all over the world are an unsafe environment. And the most safe thing is the fact that that they can't show their emotions because the other incarcerated people and the staff wouldn't accept that. They react on that. Well, that's why it's important to understand how a closed total institute as a prison works. What are the mechanisms that are in that prison. One of the very important things you can support and can do is to create a safe environment. And you make a safe environment by doing exactly what I just said. Approaching prisoners as human beings, approaching staff, it begins with the staff, approaching staff as human beings. And what I mean is when you deal with the staff, it's very important that they feel that their most important job is to create safe environments for the incarcerated people, that they are allowed to take room to find the human measure with the incarcerated people, and that they together with the incarcerated people create a safe environment for everybody instead of getting the order, well, those animals are dangerous. They can do all kinds of things, and we have a lot of examples of what these people can do. So they are only trying to attack you, to undermine you, and they're a risk for all our security. When you react on people and treat people like that, a few things happen. One thing what happens is that, of course, it becomes very unsafe for the incarcerated people. The other thing is that the guards, it's not possible for guards to have a normal contact with incarcerated people. I mean, it's very clear that one has the power and one has not the power, because one has the key and the other hasn't the key. So everybody knows that the doors get closed and that you can't try to get out. They stop you from getting out. They stop violence, etc., etc. But at the same time, within those borders, it's very well possible to treat incarcerated people like your own neighbors, like your own family. It's very, very, very well possible. Well, I think that when you, for example, I don't know if I said it the last time that I was in your show, I even had a big department of incarcerated people in my prison without staff. That were people of who were sentenced for a long time, a lot of lifers also, and they were selected by the staff. Staff looked the same way to the incarcerated people as me, and they saw a lot of people who could handle a lot more responsibility. A lot of people were in the prison for a lot of years and had recovered from all the pain and all the traumas they had when they were young and they committed their crimes. So these people were put in a group on a department. There was no staff during the day. They were out of their cells the whole day. They could go to, they all had jobs as well in the prison. And what they decided was to have a meeting every night and discuss together eventual problems that they had amongst each other, irritations, etc., etc. So every night, that was the rule they founded themselves. Every night during dinner, we speak all together about the day and we solve our problems there together. And what also happened was that in the rest of the prison, people couldn't open their cell doors because other prisoners would steal stuff and things like that. And in this department, everybody had his cell open and could put stuff in the fridge that they shared together, because they didn't steal of each other. They had a sort of situations in which they all felt that it really was worth trying to behave as good as you could. So there were also no drugs on that department. But because they were there together and they were not locked up only after 10 o'clock in the evening till the next morning, 8 o'clock. Because they were together, they could use the telephone also a lot. There were a few telephone cells on that department. So what they said was it was very important that, for example, when there are problems outside, somebody has a daughter of 14 years old, his wife calls, she says, well, sometimes she doesn't come home at night and I worry, etc., etc. And that he, as a dad, can call his daughter, his young daughter, and can talk with her every night and be a father, you know, and have a fatherly talk with her and build up a relationship.
I wanted to say one of the reasons why your countries are so well respected by U.S. citizens is because of all of these things that you've allowed, and your recidivism rate is low. The interaction between the incarcerated individuals and the staff, even yourself, has proven to be successful. You mentioned this woman, okay, she has a problem with the child. She's able to call her husband. He's able to communicate with his daughter. This just doesn't happen in this country, in the United States. Yeah. It doesn't happen.
And one of the biggest, that's very interesting, because sometimes I wonder, Mandela said, well, when you want to know a country, go look in their prisons, and then you know how a country is. And I've been in the United States a lot, also in different places, but a lot in Texas as well, which is, when you're talking about the juridical system, a very repressive state in the United States. And you meet people in the streets and families that I visited who are very friendly and kind to each other. It's not... when I walk around in Dallas or in Houston, what I see is friendly people, but the most thing that I see is that people are very separated. And so the life of the middle-class people is in their car or in a building, where they have their restaurant, their work, their sports school, the child care, etc., etc. And they go to their car, they come to their house, and the streets are for the homeless, for the psychiatric patients, for the addicted people. And you see a lot of uniforms in the street as well. So people, it seems like they have separated lives. People don't know about each other. You know, it's like when I tell people, Texan people, about what I see in the prisons, for example, they are surprised often because they don't even realize that you have a choice to do something else. So that's a very strange thing, I think, about your country, that there's a very, very nightmare-like reality of mass incarceration. Millions of very, very talented people, loving people, fathers, brothers, etc., just locked up in prisons in a very horrible and repressive way. And there are the happy Americans who seem to be better than all those people who are locked up and who lead their own lives totally separate from those people. And what you see in the Netherlands, you see a few differences between the Netherlands and the United States. One of them is that we have inequality. We have poor people as well, but a lot less than in the United States. The difference in wages between a worker or somebody who does handwork, work by hand or non-skilled jobs, and somebody who is very well skilled and is a professor or is a director or something like that, CEO, the difference between wages is not very big. You know, like I live very long in the same street where my guards lived, and there were about five levels, hierarchic levels between me and we lived in the same neighborhood because we could afford ourselves about the same sort of houses, you know, to buy. I think that's a very important aspect. And the other thing is that when I started as a director, I did it in a city of about 100,000 people who were living there. And when I went to, I lived pretty close to the, in the neighborhood, pretty close to the prison. And every day, I not only met my staff in the streets and in the shops and everywhere, but also former incarcerated people and their families. I met them. Sometimes we waved, sometimes we didn't wave, but sometimes they came to me and they shook my hand. But it was a lot more together. There was more togetherness. We knew each other, you know. When my son was small, he's now almost 40 years old, but when he was small, he brought a child every day, a very nice kid. And sometimes this kid slept with us and stuff like that. And well, one day I went to punish a guy who had dealt drugs in my prison. And then I was confronted with the father of this boy, you know, which I experienced a lot, you know, that even, you know, people who had a very bad career, that's what I call it. For example, there was a guy who I first met in a youth prison when he was about 18, and then a few times back in prison again in forensic psychiatry, and he became a hired killer. So he killed a lot of people in the Netherlands for the big mafia. So it escalated very, very bad with him. And one time he somebody in the cafe saw it, but nobody dared to witness for him, you know, he was really scary. But of witness against him, I wanted to say. And well, when he was out, I was walking with my wife on the market, and I heard behind me, "Hey Frans, do you still know me?" He called me not Mr. Dow, but Frans. And I turned around, and then I said, "Hi, Mr. Dow. Hi, Madam Dow, how are you?" And shook our hands, and then went away, you know? Because the most important thing about that is that despite the fact that he was a very troubled, very damaged guy, very damaged also by his the way he was brought up, and probably also his character. I think so. Usually it's sort of interaction when you start doing things like that, sort of interaction in between how you your characteristics when you were born, the context in which you grew up, and how that copes with the society and your environment. But what he knew was that I respected him as a person.
And he respected you back eventually, you know, calling you Mr. and your wife. That shows some form of respect. And that's probably because he saw that you were respectful of him, and he's reciprocating.
Yeah. And I think personally, and that's a very basic thing, and in all countries, we have a lot of problems with that. Right now is in the Netherlands also. It's hard for people to respect somebody who in their eyes does things or has a background that they don't support, you know, or... Mm-hmm. And I can imagine that. It's very logical, you know, when somebody, for example, kills somebody else, rapes somebody else, that is horrible, horrible, horrible. And it's very hard for people to see the person in somebody. But I think that when you're in prison, working in prison, for example, it's very important that you see the others as a person. And a person like you, and you probably has been lucky not to get incarcerated yourself, but you are the same of the guy who was incarcerated for about 98%. So there are a few things that you can do to, a lot of things you can do to make the prison secure. A secure environment. When you treat people like animals, and you the circumstances are like animals, and you all the time you let them know in every act, in every second of the day, that you only see them as dangerous and crazy and bad. And you do that all the time, and you know those guys often come from backgrounds in which they were not get all the chances, and they were blamed for everything that happened to them in their youth all the time, kicked out of school and stuff like that. It's always their fault, it's your fault, it's your fault, you are bad, you're not okay. And you get that message all the time in your life. What you expect those people to do?
Exactly. And a lot of them do say in the prisons they're called animals. They're literally called animals all the time.
Yeah. I know.
When you were talking about these people, you know, a lot of them, the way they're looked at, when it comes to mediation between the perpetrators and victims, did you ever have any problems? I'm sure there's a lot of people that don't want to do any mediation with the perpetrators, with their offenders. But have you actually had some success stories with perpetrators and the victims?
Oh, I have a hell of a lot of success stories.
Really?
It happens all the time. It happens all the time. We have this this organization, Perspective Recovery Mediation. That's the English translation of that word. It's a horrible name, but a very complicated name. But those people are fantastic. They are amazing. And they what they do is when one of the people involved in the crime on both sides, wants to have a conversation, then they make contact with both the parties and they start having conversations about what they expect, why they do it, etc., etc. Because the most important thing is that both the victims or survivors and the perpetrator is hurt in the process. You know, you don't want to do that. You know that especially when the family of somebody who is killed talks to the killer, and it turns out that the killer is not sincere at all. You know, for example, and those people are victimized for the second time. You don't want that to happen. So prepare the conversation very careful, very, very good, you know. They do it so good that when they finally meet each other, sometimes it is a very small success. Sometimes there's not much that happens. Sometimes it's a very big success. But what never happens, I've never experienced that it increased the pain, you know. It was always that people afterwards said, well, it was a good thing I did this, you know. What I experienced was, I can tell a lot of stories. A friend of mine, he became a friend because we did a lot together. His daughter was killed by a former friend, was stabbed 35 times and killed.
Wow.
His beautiful daughter of 21 years old. And the guy was locked up in my prison for many years. And, because I was a friend of him also, because his daughter had been on athletics with my children and things. We had a lot of conversations, and his wife wrote a very famous book about the whole thing and about her process of dealing with this. It's called Mum, I'll Call You Back in a Moment, because she telephoned with her daughter and the daughter said, Mom, I tell you, I call you back in a moment, and then she was killed. Those people did a lot in the Netherlands of, for example, doing all kinds of groups. The father is visiting prisons for the last 15 years almost every week, prisons all over the Netherlands where he tells his story to groups of incarcerated people and talk about what happened, about what the consequences were for him. And what he always says to me is, well, people in those groups are very honest about their feelings about themselves. They have a very big problem in forgiving themselves for the things that they did. But he also experiences that the people often are victims themselves. They have been in all kinds of situations where they were a victim themselves. And being a victim is very painful. And one of the things you do, and we spoke about that before, when you're a victim and you don't do something with that pain, it goes somewhere, and usually it ends in violence, you know, to somebody else. So that's his experience, and he's very popular because the incarcerated people are free to go or not to go to his meetings, but it's always full. There are always big groups of people listening to him. Well, after about 7 years, he said to me, Frans, I want to talk to the perpetrator. And I said, well, you can do that. You go to this organization, and see people who make that contact and who prepare you for that meeting and who prepare the other party for that meeting. And he had this conversation with this guy. And it really helped them in the sense that they had a lot of questions about why and how and et cetera, et cetera. And the guy answered as honest as he could. So he was honest. He was sincere. They all cried during the meeting. It was very emotional. They also were very angry. The wife, the mother of the killed daughter, was very angry and said to him what she felt about him and what he and he could hear that as well, and he understood that, and he really said, "I'm sorry." And what happened after that meeting is that the father, he said, "Well, I want to continue visiting this guy. I want to continue visiting this guy." And he, during those years until last year the guy was on parole outside, he visited him in prison and had talks with the guy. The daughter of those people, the sister of the killed girl, she had a very bad time after the killing. She worked as a teacher. She couldn't work as a teacher anymore. She went to a very, very harsh period with all kinds of physical and mental problems with the whole thing, which is very... which I hear and see a lot, that especially survivors of a crime like that can, you know, get into a crisis and get a sort of PTSS, and this PTSS can be very complicated and very hard to cure, you know, to get over.
Yeah.
And well, she's a real warrior, this lady. I know her very well. And she after 12 years after the killing, she went to this guy, this perpetrator, and she forgave him. She went to him and she forgave him. And had a conversation with him. And she even, and that's what I remember, because she told... the whole process in detail to me. A lot happened in that conversation, but what touched me the most is that she said, for the first time I could understand why my sister was in love with him. She could feel that. Before that, she couldn't. He was violent. She couldn't understand that. She saw him as a monster. And she, after 12 years and after that conversation, she understood. She saw that he also had very nice aspects in his character. And, well, I also spoke with the mother of this guy because in my prison we had a play. A famous Dutch actor did actor classes in the prison, in which he said, well, I do the same classes as I do on the academy, the theater academy, a master class he did with prisoners. And the thing about acting, being an actor, is that you have to show your feelings, you know? You have to show yourself to the world on the stage. And this guy who killed the lady, his mother had all kinds of relationships, different relationships with all kinds of violent men during his youth. So there was a lot of violence in the house. Mm. And what happened was that when he was very small, when he was a little small kid, he decided not to feel anything anymore. You know, that was his survival strategy.
Exactly.
Not feeling anymore. And this guy didn't feel anything anymore, but he had no way, he didn't know how to express his feelings one way or the other. So that was the reason why he also became so incredibly explosive. Well, in that play, the famous actor is also a friend of mine, and he said to me, well, this guy, every day, every time he came to class, it was like jumping from a mountain, you know, in a valley, you know, down 100 meters. It was like killing himself. It was very hard for him. He didn't sleep two nights before every meeting, but he did it, you know. So he was very much confronted in the whole process with his pain and with his fears, and he really tried to get through, to get around this decision he made as a 4 or 5 year old boy, not to feel anything anymore. And then there was this play, and I allowed the family of the incarcerated people to come and to watch the play in the prison. And his mother was crying, and she said, well, I always knew that he had this in him. Basically, he's a very soft boy, and he's a nice boy, but I haven't seen it since he was 4 or 5 years old. I always knew it was there. But this is the first time that I see it again. So that's what I say. What I try to tell is that you have to create an environment in the prison also, in which people can show who they are, get confronted with their pain, and process it so that they can forgive themselves, and to get over and around the traumas of their own crime and everything that happened before. And then they can become people who say, and he is a guy like that right now, this guy. I meet him sometimes, and he's outside. And he is a guy who fully convinced, decided not to hurt anyone in his life anymore. He doesn't want that anymore. He doesn't want it. He doesn't do it, you know?
You know, you've done an awful lot, not only as a warden, but it's almost like you have that psychological training in your mind, in your being. And everything that you're talking about, would take not only a warden, but it would take psychologists, it would take psychiatrists. Everything you're talking about is combined into one being, yourself. And that doesn't happen here in the United States. And that's the sad thing about it.
That's very sad, because what I'm telling you is just, I'm not a professor, I'm not a psychologist, not very intellectual. I'm also not exceptionally intelligent or things like that. I'm just a human being. And the things that I say are, they go for everybody, for all of us.
I mean, you're the co-founder of the Foundation of Recovery and Return. You have your own radio, Friday night radio podcast. And I want to let everybody know, Franz Dahl has a radio podcast, and it's at www.prisonhow.nl. And everyone, please listen to his radio show sometimes. But Franz, what I was going to say is, you have put yourself in so many situations that have been successful in with bringing the perpetrators and the victims together, you know, in working, interacting with the incarcerated yourself, and the way you and your staff, it's just unbelievable. I can see why the success in your country is so great.
Well, it's a very simple principle of I work hard for that, I must say, and I'm trained in that, and I really, because I'm a human being, and I also have my opinion about people and what people do, et cetera, et cetera. And I also have some frustrations. But what I try to do is not to react out of frustration to people when they touch me. And what I try to do, not to have a judgment about people. And it's very simple. When you don't do that and you stay on your own square meter, you accept other people, then you are safe for people. And when people feel that you are safe, then you can very easily connect people. What we do is we organize meetings during the whole year. We have one tomorrow, for example. And then we do meetings with former incarcerated people, with families of incarcerated people, but also with victims and with professionals. And we just meet. And the only thing I do is inviting them, and being the person they all know that they can tell everybody to him. If everybody can do, nothing is forbidden, everything is allowed. And we are in a place. It's a building my son owns, and we just meet. And it's always a very amazing thing. And it's a safe place, you know.
That's what they need. Exactly.
And that's what we all need. That's what we all need. When you are grown up in a situation that was safe, and you know that you are like me. I'm white. My parents love me. So I was safe during my youth. And when I came in, started working, I was also respected. People saw my talents. They supported me. They invited me. They gave me chances, etc., etc. That was my life.
You know what you just said? I have to reiterate on this. You said my parents loved me. Do you know, I always say this, if more parents show their child or their children that love rather than to teach them hatred, we wouldn't be having the problems that we have in the United States of America. But so many parents raise their children not to give them that love that you speak of, but to teach their kids how to hate somebody that's different from them. And that's
very true, but it's also people who do that, those parents, they also do that because of their own fear and their own pain and their own... for example, a subject that I deal a lot with and that I meet a lot is about masculinity and masculine and woman, men and women, the role models, you know. What? How do you need to behave, to look, to be when you are a real woman? And how do you have to look, to behave, to be a real man, you know? When I look at what you have to be like as a man, I almost don't know anybody who meets that profile, you know? Because a man has to be tough and he has to be caring, he has to have a solution for every problem, he has to protect everybody, etc., etc. He has to earn the money, he has to be the boss, he has to be, you know, etc., etc. I see a lot of people getting into criminality because they can't meet the demands that of being a real man, you know? And then they start behaving like that, you know, tough. When you show your feelings, you get vulnerable. So when you love your children, you learn them not to show their feelings because you don't want them to get into trouble, you know, the whole pattern, you know, like, so it's not because parents don't love their children. It is because the parents don't deal with their own fear and their own pain. And they give it over to their children, I think.
Man is human. Just like women, man is human, and they should be able to cry. They should be able to express their emotions. You know, everybody feels as though they have to please others. They don't have to please anyone but themselves. And what you're doing, I mean, you're showing masculinity just in all the things that you're doing. It seems like you're not allowing people from the outside to enter into your own physical being in the way you are. You have a good relationship with your children. Your parents loved you. They raised you the right way. You look at the incarcerated accordingly. You don't judge all incarcerated to be violent or evil. And you're coming out with programs that help them. You're doing the perpetrators and victims mediation. I mean, you're doing all the things that would be expected of a man or even a woman, but you're not having to do all this masculinity to show that you are a successful male.
Yeah, and the only success that I have is that I, and the only leadership that I do is that I somehow manage to make leaders of other people. That I managed to make people doing their best. I'm not the one doing it, you know. I'm not the one doing it. When somebody goes down, when my grandson is on his bike and he falls down and he cries, then I comfort him. And then I say, well, you can do it. You can do it. You can. Just try it again, you know, because I know you can do it. And then he does it again, and he smiles because he did it, you know. and that's a very human, important human thing. And we all need that. And when you didn't get it and start committing crimes, then in the prison you need to, they need to meet people who do that with them because they didn't get that often. Yeah, they need, sometimes it's a guard. They have a click with and a guard who says, well, I know you have been in prison 30 times and I know you're addicted on hard drugs, but I see you and I see how intelligent you are. And I see that you have the best intention. So I believe in you. How can I support you to make other choices? And then the guy goes, gets a book to study, and then he has a period in which he is not motivated and doesn't study. And then the guard doesn't say to him, well, you didn't study, you're a bad person, it's not okay, I believe in you, but I see how you deal with it, it's not okay. No, he says, okay, you didn't study the last 2 months, but I know you can do it. So I advise you to try it again, because serious, I know, I see, when you do your best, you can do it. You know?
You have support of guards. That's the one thing, I'm glad you brought that up. There are so many people incarcerated who have such low self-esteem.
Incredible.
They don't think that they're capable of doing something positive, of becoming successful. And just statements like you just mentioned, letting them know they do have this potential.
Yeah.
So many people incarcerated learned how to, after incarceration, learned how to write poetry, sing, write music. A lot of them started their own things while incarcerated. But they just need that little push, like you mentioned, to know that they can do it.
And it's something about how do we look to other people? And it's not only how we look at incarcerated people, but when I live in the village, how do I look at people who are poor, who are in a poor situation, who don't have work, who have to go to the food bank, you know, to get food and stuff like that? How do I look at the children? What we do as a society is punish them all the time. Punish them by the way we look at them. You know, they're losers. We did our best. That's the reason why we have a good situation. That's the reason why we can buy food and have a nice house. That's what we think. It's not true. There are people like us. They're people like us. They have the same feelings, the same dreams, etc., etc. They have also the same talents. They're as talented and energetic as we are, you know, as I am. That's the truth. That's the truth. They're the same. So the most destructive thing is when you are not in a situation that you can cope with society easily by all kinds of circumstances in your upbringing, for example, then it's very hard, and that's very logical to believe in yourself. One of the things that happens always when you have problems at home. There's violence at home because father drinks and has no jobs and stuff like that. Which has also a lot of causes why he is like that. Then you go to school and you get into a fight and you get trouble. And even when you come from that family, at school, the teachers will react often, and the whole system will react, you're from that family, you're from that neighborhood, you know?
Yeah.
And when something is stolen in the class, the first person they look at, that's you, you know?
It's sad, because in the United States, as I always say, we have representatives from every country in the world in the United States. And I am a firm believer of cultures and different cultures and how they discipline and how they raise their children, you know. And I grew up calling the adults Mr. and Mrs. or Miss, and we had to respect even our teachers, our mailman, you know, the newspaper man. We had to show a lot of respect, which is now in this country, we don't have the role models that we once had. Unfortunately,
it's a problem. Yeah, but I personally believe I work a lot with young people, and of course I have children, grandchildren, but I also visit a lot youth prisons and youth institutions. I do lectures there, and I work with the staff and with the incarcerated children. And I have a lot of young people who come on our meetings from the Foundation of Recovery and Return. So I keep energetic and inspired, especially by all those young people. And I must say that I think they are very respectful in general. They are very respectful. And I think that when the children of a country don't respect the elders and the older people, then there's something wrong with the way we deal with them. We think about them. But there's this famous saying, it takes a village to raise a child.
Exactly.
But when the child doesn't feel the heat of the village, he will burn it down to feel its heat. Yeah, something like that, not exactly the words, but that's what happens, you know, when we create our own children.
I remember going on a retreat one time, and there were some young people there from New York, these three young men. And at this retreat, it was supposed to be like for a week. And I was walking by the kitchen, and one of the young men was flirting with one of the girls in the kitchen. And I said something about, don't get too close or something like that. And he said, who is she and all this, and really ignorant towards me. But, you know, by the time the retreat got over, I had talked with those young men. And they used to tell me when they walked out of their home in New York, as soon as they walked out the door onto the steps, the police were harassing them. So they had this attitude about everyone that was an adult because of what they had been experiencing. And it was good because they saw in me that they didn't have to feel that way because, like you, I talked to them and I understood where they were coming from. But that's what we're lacking.
Exactly. And what I also think is, I think children and parents and adults are equal. They are equal human beings. They have different roles. When I see children do things that are not allowed or I'm worried about, it's not my first step, especially when I don't know them, to make a correction to them, you know, to tell, to say something. And I'm sure you said it very friendly with the best intentions, but the guy has a point when he says, well, who is she, you know, to say that to me, you know? So what I always, where I believe it, is that that the relation is very important, you know? So it's better to base your interventions towards somebody on the relation you have with him or her. That's what I try to do.
Well, you know, with me, especially with adolescents, because I, being a social worker, I work with a lot of adolescents. But with me, I joke with them. And when I said what I did, it was kind of like on a joking basis, but he didn't know me. So he probably, you know, took it, as you mentioned, he probably thought I was serious. But I'm the type of person, I will joke with the adolescents because that's the only way to relate to them.
Yeah, that's the point. And I can really understand very well how you, what happens, you know, and that it's pretty logical. And it could happen to me as well, that I make a remark like that. But I think it's important that he knows you first, that you have some kind of context. It can be only in sentences of a word or what I always think also is you need to show somebody that you see him, that you that your intention is not to change him or do something with him or whatever, you know. You just have to show other people that they can be who they are, you know.
Exactly.
And sometimes that only takes 1 minute or a few seconds to convince the other people that you're okay and with who he is and that you accept him as he is. When that base is there, a remark about, you know, I'm a little bit scared or afraid, I hope you take good care of her,
Yeah.
Or you probably say, I know that you will take good care of her because she's still a young girl, for example. Huh? Mm. Then a remark lands in a different way. So for me, it's all about respecting, accepting, seeing, recognizing somebody for the person he is.
And they go through a lot. The youth today, especially today, back then it was just as bad, but the youth today are going through so much because there's no role models and there's so much division in this country. As you mentioned, you know, you've been in this country. You've been in the prisons in some of these states. You know, you still continue to advocate with those in Texas. There's so many people, young people in this country that don't have any role models anymore. There's no role models. We see it in our Republican and Democrat Party. I mean, they're like high school kids going after one another and using the American people as their justification for, you know, the injustices going on.
Yeah, it's a little bit from a distance. Huh? All the Americans, I think they're good people. They're good people. Actually, I even believe that all the Russians are good people. I've been in Russia also a lot of times.
You know, that's another thing I want to say real quickly is I love Vladimir Putin, and I'll say why. Because he is not a phony. You know, he does not like a lot of the things that go on in the United States, you know, and all that. And I respect him for that. He's being honest.
Who? I didn't hear the name. Who?
Vladimir Putin from Russia. I used to have a Russian doctor. I respect him. Because I like honesty. I don't like a lot of deception, and I don't like corruption, and I don't like lies. And sometimes through my own experiences, there's been a lot of lies put out there about a lot of people in other countries. And I've traveled 11 countries, and all the talk that they did about these countries being violent, they all were hospitable to me. They were respectful. Anybody from America, they surely respected. But yet, I was told by so many in this country not to go to these countries because they're violent. They're going to treat you wrong and all this. Mm. It's not true. So I've learned. I've learned a lot about some of these issues that they talk about.
Yeah, I think I read a few books about Putin. I even sat on a chair in a restaurant in St. Petersburg where he has sat in. But to tell you the truth, I understand very well where he comes from. But I also, as a person, but I also think that he does and did horrible things. Horrible things. He is, and the same goes for quite a few other politicians. Also, politicians from your country. Yeah.
We have human rights violations right here in the United States. They cover up. They go to these other countries and talk about the human rights violations in their countries when we have it here, especially in our prisons here. And we have a government country that's so quick to go over and talk about other people's business when they have to get their own business taken care of in this country. Human rights violations.
Yeah, I know. And it happens all the time. And when people were treated with human dignity, when their human dignity was respected. And that goes not only for the incarcerated people, but also for the staff, and for the policemen in your country, and for the people, well, everybody in the United States. And when human dignity would be respected, it would be a total, total different situation. Because I see an experience during my whole career that even people who are very hurt, very angry, very damaged, when you respect their human dignity, then the process of recovery starts and you see totally different people.
Yeah.
So I'm very worried about what happened, not only in the United States, but also in Western Europe and also in the Netherlands, because the whole what happens, for example, with immigrants over here and the way people look at immigrants. And when I see that in the prison system, I'm retired now, it gets more repressive all the time, then I see that this polarization that you see in the United States, of course, well, I see it in the whole Western world. I see it.
You know, they can, if they didn't, if they don't like you, or if they're like, okay, Ukraine and Russia, I don't get into it, but I will say one thing. If they, a lot of them don't like Russia. So what they do is they try to get the whole world, even their enemies, who were not allies with certain countries, but all of a sudden now they're trying to become friends with other countries because they want their support in going against another country.
Yeah,
this is what happens in the United States, even with advocates. This happens with a lot of people. If you don't like somebody, you're going to try to get as many people to turn against that individual or that organization or that group, whatever it is. This is what's been happening these last few years. And it's sad. Yeah. Look, immigration. Look at all these children that lost their parents. They
incredible.
Don't know who their parents were. And these parents, probably half of them have been executed before being deported. And now you have all these children, and this government doesn't know. They can't match the children to their parents because they didn't keep a dialogue or something. This is inhumane.
Yeah, but did I tell you about that I work also in Ukraine right now?
No.
Next month, I go to Ukraine for the second time during the war with a team. Because before the war, I did a lot in reform of forensic psychiatry and prisons as a foreign expert in Ukraine and other Eastern Europe countries. And they asked us to support them in creating a special facility for staff who is often traumatized and incarcerated people who are often traumatized because they come from the war with some PTSS and start committing crimes and stuff like that.
That's what I have on you, the global initiative on psychiatry that you are involved. You're also involved in the United Nations and you are so, I don't know how you manage to do all these things without having a breakdown, but you are doing so much work.
Now, like what we can do all the time is just be ourselves, you know?
Yeah.
You can be, that's the only thing you can do wherever you are. So that's what I do. I don't get exhausted by being myself.
You're doing an awesome job. You are awesome. Everything that you do is just unbelievable. And this country should take examples from your country. This is why I say many have gone over to Norway because Norway is supposed to be the expert or the most successful of all prisons throughout the world. And yet they go over to your country and they come back and they do nothing with what they're learning when they go to your country. Yeah. I don't know if it's because they don't want to look like they're the ones that are taking advice, you know, from other countries. They want to be on the top. But if that's the case, they're being very selfish. But if they go to your country, they see all these success stories. They should be implementing them in the United States of America, in the penal system in this country.
Well, I think the most important thing is that you find a way in the United States to look different to each other. I think that's very important because there are a lot of good people living in the United States, and especially separating throw people out of society who are different or where you have an opinion about, that's the biggest, that's actually the biggest problem. That's actually the biggest problem.
You touched on that earlier. You mentioned that earlier too. And that's true. It's people like we have the wealthy, we have the average citizen, we have the poverty stricken. So we're dealing with different levels.
Maybe I can give an example. The last time I was in Ukraine, we were working on the subject of when you're a traumatized staff member and you're a traumatized incarcerated people, when they meet each other, you get a lot of violence, you know? It's a very bad situation. and when both sides are traumatized. It's an explosive mix, you know?
Yes.
So an important aspect we discussed long about was, how do you look at the other one? Can you look at the other one as somebody who is the same as yourself? And you even probably, while you are a guard and the other one is an incarcerated guy, you even can go through the same process together, you know? Okay. And later, the boss of the prison system comes from east of Ukraine, where and she speaks Russian, and she likes to speak Russian, but she is Ukrainian. And one of the most important issues we talked about during one of those afternoons was, is she allowed to speak Russian? Is she allowed to be Ukrainian, to want to fight for her country, be loyal to her country, and at the same time speak Russian? Because she felt when other people, because speaking Russian is very, people get very angry when she does that. But for her, it's a part of her personality, because she was brought up in an environment where everybody spoke Russian. You understand me?
Wasn't Russia and Ukraine, wasn't all that at one time, wasn't it all one under the U.S.?
Yeah, it was. Yes. It's only about 30 years independent, I think.
Yeah.
Ukraine, yeah. So it's about difference, and where I would like to talk about is, what I want to stress on is that when you allow everybody to be what they are, you know, what he or she is, then you get an atmosphere of security. So the intervention in this discussion was, can everybody in this room, because we do a training here, we are going to build up a facility, a prison facility for a special group of people. Let's start to make an environment that is secure for everybody who is here, you know?
People, and that's what people should.
Yeah.
Sometimes I believe in maintaining or remaining neutral in all situations. You try to there's no way you can remain neutral, because everybody expects you to take sides. But I try to remain neutral in everything. And
well, what I do is I'm not neutral. What I try to do is to choose for everybody.
That's right.
Because when you're neutral, that gives a sort of idea of not choosing.
Yeah.
And I think in life is complex, and there's always evil. There's love on one side, there's evil on the other side. That's our environment. That's how life is, you know? So that's how we are. We people have very evil aspects and characteristics, and very, very loving characteristics. So that's how it is. So, and what I do is I choose for the loving part of people.
Yes.
When you are a very nice, loving person, best intentions, but you beat up people because you have pain you don't want to be confronted with, then I reject your actions of beating people, because I hate it. I hate people who beat people.
Yeah.
And who are violent. I hate that. I don't hate that people. I don't say it. Okay. I hate those actions. But I don't hate those people. I love the other parts of almost everybody. I can't remember meeting, also in prison, somebody who is only bad. I never met him.
And as you said, you mentioned you met with them. You met with a lot of them, and you got to know what was going on, you know, behind the scene, what they were going through. You know, we have in this country, in the United States of America, we have two states that never took away the prisoners' rights to vote, and that is Maine and Vermont in the United States. Mm-hmm. Every other state, they've taken away the prisoners' rights to vote, even though the crime was not against the country. And Brian Winters was a politician in Vermont, and he is no longer a politician. He started an American Union, and what he does is he will support whatever party is for the cause. And one of the causes that he is for is to abolish or eliminate mass incarceration in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are the only country in the world that has mass incarceration.
Very true.
It's people like that that I have a lot of respect for, because they're not just taking sides because because that's their party. They're taking sides with whomever is in for the cause to do something good and not do something bad.
It looks like I listen to it like this guy is sees that an incredible injustice happens in society by locking up those people. Huge pain and injustice done and harm to a lot of people, very injustice. And he tries to do something about it. And that's and what I think is that, and I'm curious about how he does it, because when you fight something, when you fight a system, it usually is not very effective, especially when you fight the power system of a country. That's a very hard thing to do. What, as a tragedy, I try to do is to inspire people and make people aware of their own responsibility and their own part of what happens around them.
Yeah.
We have a neighbor over here in this city where I live now, where there are a lot of drugs crimes, there are a lot of immigrants, there are a lot of people in bad situations. And I was speaking for a group of middle-class ladies from a middle-class ladies club, also here in the neighborhood. And they said to me, well, Mr. Dow, you're talking about very positive about the possibilities of people, et cetera, et cetera. But in this neighborhood, those people are committing crimes all the time and they don't want something else. And what are we going to do with them? And then I was talking about their part in the fact that these kids are behaving like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
About that at the end of the, when they're selected for school, they go to a lower school. That when they want an internship, they don't get it. When they get a job, they don't get it. And that everywhere that they come in the formal society, the doors are closed for them because they have a certain image about it. Then, and at the end of the night, a lady stood up and she said, well, we were talking about what you said tonight. And is it true that you say that we don't have to interfere in the lives of all those people in that neighborhood and do this and do that and do such and do so? That the most important thing that we can do is treat them like we treat our own people, like, because we meet them in the shops, they bring our food at our home, we see them in the streets, they apply for jobs, you know. We meet them all the time, and when we treat them without any judgment, not with and don't listen to our fear, we create the space together for them to integrate in society and to get a better life. And I said, I never thought about that like that, but I said, I thought for a while, for a few seconds, and I said, I think you're right.
I admire students that are going for the internships. I encourage a lot of organizations, even law firms, to let these students do their internships. Let them do some volunteer work, because a lot of them are going to school for law, medicine. A lot of them are going to school for criminal justice, and they're looking for organizations that will let them do some volunteer work for the experience to do their internships.
Yeah. Yeah, the last 10 years, I'm a lot asked to become a member of the board of all kinds of organizations, for example. As a white guy with my career is asked a lot for those kinds of positions. I always say no, and I always say I know a lot of who are not invited for those jobs, who are younger than me, who have more energy, who have all kinds of new ideas and a lot of talents, and who can develop in a function like that. So I always come with another candidate from one of those groups, always. When people say, when people invite me to speak to at the university of all kinds of other places, I always take an experienced expert with me. Always somebody who has been in prison, etc., etc. If we still have time, I have a nice story about that, how that can work.
I want to say real quickly, I know it's around 9:30 your time at night, so if you don't mind, we can continue with this for another half hour, but I don't want to overextend, you know, my welcome having you come on the show, because I'm keeping you too long. But I would like to hear the story.
That's my wife is downstairs, and it's also nice to sit and have a cup of tea before we go to sleep and watch a bit television. But this is a nice story, I think. This is a guy who has been in prison, and he met a few people. He really gave him a chance. He started restaurants, he started coffee bars, etc., etc. And because he got this chance from people who believed in him, he wanted to give former incarcerated people, like he had been himself, give a chance in his company. What he did, it was a coffee company. They burned coffee beans, and then they could get training as a barista and stuff like that. Huh? And he called me, and I said, "Well, come to the prison, because I have a proposal for you." And I said to him, "Well, you are talking about former incarcerated people, but I want to ask you to start your company inside my prison, because I have space, I have rooms where people can do work, and I have a lot of staff around here. So just start your company and treat the incarcerated people like you treat other talented staff. You select them, you train them, you make them ready to get outside, and when they get outside, they can work in your restaurants and your coffee shops, etc." And that's what we did. He went in our prison. He now has this kind of labor projects in almost every prison in the Netherlands, but he also have a whole network of restaurants and coffee shops, etc., etc., also in the center of Amsterdam, where people can drink very nice coffee, and being served by former incarcerated people. And when you go drink coffee over there, I go there often, then you see very interested middle class and high class people drinking a nice coffee there and listening to the stories those guys tell them about their recovery, about how they changed their life. That's what happens all the time. And people like that, you know, it's a hopeful message. Well, one day the Council of Europe asked me to go to Moldavia, which is one of the poorest countries in Europe. And there was a conference, and it was about the first drug therapeutic department in a Moldavian prison. It had to be opened. And I said, well, I want to come, but I don't need the fee. You give your fee to the guy and the travel expenses to the guy I bring with you. And I took Jemuel with me, this friend of mine. And it was very interesting because Jemuel was the only black guy in the whole conference. Well, people from Georgia and from Serbia and from Poland, etc., etc. They were all white. And probably he was the only black guy in the whole country, in the whole Moldavia. You didn't see black people over there.
Wow.
And then we two climbed on the stage, and I did my story about people, you know, and about prisons. And then Jemuel came, and he had a lot of pictures of his guys with T-shirts and with the tattoos and with their coffee and tea and their bakeries, etc., etc. And there were all those Eastern Europe officials sitting in this it was a sort of theater, and a lot of them were crying. They were very inspired and very emotional about it.
Wow.
And then the next day, we went to this prison to open that department, that therapeutic department. And it was very stiff, very Eastern Europe-like, you know, just very formal, you know. And then all of a sudden, Jemuel stood up and he said, well, Minister, we're going to make a photograph all together. And then all the people started smiling, and we were all in a big group, and they were making photos, etc., etc. So he had an incredible impact. And then the Council of Europe said, well, they said to me, we want to see this guy all the time. We will do his projects in all Europe and everywhere. We will promote it, etc., etc. And then they invited him to go the next time to Georgia, in Eastern Europe, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And typical for me, but also for Jemuel, he didn't go. He sent his boys. He sent his boys. The boys that just came from prison, he let them do the story and have this experience that he had. And that was so nice and so typical for the way he works. And also the way you have to do it, you know? That's the way you have to do it. You have to create chances for other people, not for yourself, for other people.
Yeah. I actually met somebody from Georgia, and when I was in Central America, I believe it was El Salvador or Honduras, and he was a young man from Georgia, and I didn't know there was another Georgia outside of Georgia in the United States, and then I found out there was. But it was interesting meeting him to learn about a little bit about Georgia and Europe.
I think it's very interesting. I've been in Georgia a lot. As a prison director, I went to abroad at least once a month, and usually during the weekend or a long weekend, and for about almost 25 years, I did all kinds of projects, knowledge exchange in those kind of countries.
Mm.
So one thing I learned is that you're not there to tell them what to do.
Yeah.
You're there to learn yourself, to broaden your view on your profession and on the world. And probably you can be there when they try to find their own solutions in their own context, inspired probably by you, you know? And that's what I did in Georgia as well. I went there at least 6 or 7 times. In forensic psychiatry and in prisons. Yeah. It's a beautiful country, it is. It's a beautiful country.
You know, there's a lot of people in this country, prisoners actually, that would, they've asked in the past, and I know it's not possible, but they've asked, why can't they have some kind of project where they can send so many people over to Norway or to one of these other European countries so that we can show them that we can learn? Or why don't they bring them over here? And you know something, I often wondered if that was ever a possibility. I think it would be good to have a pilot project, either to bring some over here or to bring some over there, just to get that experience, the difference in the way that they are, the prisons are run and the treatment.
Well, I'm sure that when I have a friend in for example, in a prison in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that, and this friend, he does also all kinds of projects with other incarcerated people. All kinds of trainings for how to be a good dad, how to become less violent, how to deal with pain. My friend is a very talented guy who is already 35 years in prison. So the only thing you need to do really is collect, and they are in every prison, guys like that, groups of guys like that who have this talent. Just create some space for them to build their own community, positive community.
Exactly.
And then they can do it. They can do it easily. And you can bring somebody from Norway to. It's always nice to have some foreign eyes being involved and following
exactly.
The project.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying.
But
if they could. If, like you, you've been in the prisons in the U.S., if there could be others like yourself, or maybe if you've brought others with you, so that they can do some work, some volunteer work or some kind of work in the prison to kind of like recruit these people or help these people to get these kind of programs going in the prison.
Yeah. It's very... it happens in the United States also sometimes, this kind of projects. I don't know how it was called. I've seen a clip on YouTube of incarcerated people going through their pain in a group, and it was together with people from the neighborhood, from outside. They came in the prison,
yeah.
And together they went through their pain. Do you know what I mean? It's very famous.
No. But I will say, the difference is, in this country, every state operates differently. The problems are all the same in every state. But every state operates, every governor in every state operates differently. So some may be, like the death penalty. Greg Abbott, who is the governor of Texas, and he still has the death penalty. Some Pennsylvania, Governor Shapiro, he just got rid of the death penalty. But some of them have the death, and I'm against the death penalty for one reason. First of all, it's not a good example to kill somebody that has killed somebody. I mean, it's like do as I say, not as I do. And this is what happens in Texas and other places that have the death penalty. They're killing somebody. They're doing the exact same thing. And years later, a month later, they find a lot of these people they've executed were innocent.
Yeah.
So it doesn't make sense.
But
every state operates differently. So whatever programs you or others that you may bring over or have come over or even that are here, everyone that's doing it in certain states, they're not doing it in all the states, which they should, because this is a national problem.
Yeah, very true.
But
Leona, let's say one few last words before I go sit on the couch with my wife.
I want everyone to know you will be back next Wednesday to talk on the medical care in prisons, and also the relationships between staff and inmates. And as I say, we have a few after that. But Franz, I want to thank you so much. You have been a blessing to bring in awareness in this country of how we can improve the prisons, just based on what you yourself have done.
Well, thank you very much. And for me, it's very rewarding to hear that you say things like this, because at least I have the idea that I inspire you by telling my story.
It's something that a lot of people in this country need to hear. And I want to also thank your wife and apologize to her as well for keeping you up this late and preventing you from having your tea together. But tell her I said thank you as well for allowing you to come on the show. And I think you're really awesome. I think you're doing an excellent job. And I look forward to next Wednesday having you come back on again.
And thank you very much, Leona.
We'll get some questions at the end of your series, but right now I think everyone's just absorbing what you're saying because it makes so much sense, and it's a success story. So I thank you so much again, Franz, for coming on.
Thank you, Leona, and see you the next time, next week.
Okay, thank you so much.
Looking forward. Bye-bye.
Audience, we are now going to end this episode, and I look forward to having our guest back on next Wednesday. Please join us, 2 o'clock Eastern Time. PM, and that will be 8 o'clock Amsterdam time. Please join us next Wednesday, and we are now going to end this episode. Thank you very much.